Welcome to the Surviving Grief Podcast, hosted by our grief ministry leaders at Crossroads Church. We'll be sitting down with friends as they share their powerful stories of loss and healing, and we'll hear from grief professionals and other wise people with useful tools for our own time of grief. If you're supporting someone who's grieving, you'll learn how to comfort them and walk with them on their own path to healing. Let's join the conversation.
My name is Casey, and I'm a teacher. I teach second grade in Fort Thomas. I am married to John. He is a principal in Fort Thomas at an elementary school. We have two kids here with us, John and Macy. They're twins. They are 11. They're in fifth grade. And Charlie, who is in heaven. So we had a difficult time getting pregnant. Met with our doctor, and he prescribed us some medication. We ended up getting pregnant with the twins. It was very exciting. John's dad is a twin. We have a lot of friends that were twins. It was exciting. So we had Johnny and Macy in 2012, and then we kind of assumed that we would have issues getting pregnant again, and we did not. So we got pregnant pretty quickly. After the twins, that they were like one and a half-ish. And they, we got pregnant with Charlie. When we had the twins, everybody kind of, you know, that twin thing. Oh, is it a boy and a girl? Yeah, it's a boy and a girl. Oh, you're perfect. You don't have to have any more. It's like the whole, it's a thing, conversation you always have with twins. And so when we got pregnant, not only was I thinking like, What are we gonna do? But also, like, they're one and a half, and this is gonna be a lot. So there was some anxiety around Charlie and just the beginning stages of getting pregnant with him. It was totally unexpected. And actually, full disclosure, I thought I was pregnant at school and went to Walgreens and got a test and took it in the bathroom at Walgreens while somebody else watched my class. But anyways, when I came back to school, I told John, and he was so excited. My husband was so excited, and I was not. And I just thought, like, this is not right. Like, we have two beautiful kids. Everything is perfect. What are we doing? And so it just really messed with my head. I was really struggling to figure out how this fit in my plan, in the plan that I thought that I had for our life. And I am the kind of person that is very, I wouldn't say controlling. My husband might. I would say more like wants to have a plan, wants to be ready for everything, always, you know, just a do-it-all. From the outside, looking really strong and ready and good to go. And this was really changing that for me. Like, what are we going to do? So we go through the pregnancy. I start to obviously get more used to the idea, kind of feel more comfortable. And I just... I start to go into labor with Charlie. I thought my water was going to break. My water broke with the twins. It did not with Charlie. So I was 8 centimeters when we got to the hospital. There was some rushing around. There was some, you know, stress involved with this delivery. He broke his collarbone when he was delivered. The doctor had to kind of pull him in a funny way. Broke his collarbone. He was struggling when he came out. So they did all the tests, all the things. He ended up being fine. Everything was good. He's great. You guys, you're good to go home. So we now have three kids under two, because the twins were not yet two. So I guess they were probably one when we got pregnant. But anyways, he came home with us. Everything was great. We were figuring it all out. Fast forward a few days. It is July 4th. I mean, he was born on June 30th. So July 4th, my favorite holiday of all time. I love July 4th. Family and, you know, fireworks, and our town has a parade, and it's always a big deal. So I said, we're taking him to the parade. This is like, he's coming with us. So we go. It was really hard. He was, you know, 4 days old, but we made it. People got to see him. It was exciting. Showed him off a little bit. I'm like, okay, we can do this, John. Like, this is good. You know, like, we're gonna make it. So like, I'm starting to now form all these new plans. Like, okay, now that I know this is okay, I know this is gonna work, we're gonna do this, and we'll go on spring break on this trip, and we'll do this. And I have all these grand plans for our family now. It's a family of five. We are together. We are, you know, my outlook totally changed. And I feel like that's why sometimes God gives us those 9 months to like wrap our heads around what's about to happen. So we do the 4th. It's an awesome day. My parents come in from Lexington. John's family's there. We have a great day. We have all kinds of pictures from the 4th. Fast forward a couple days, and we're all exhausted. And again, we have three kids under two. The twins need our attention. Charlie needs our attention. And Charlie is, you know, waking up to eat every 3 hours. Well, this particular evening, he didn't wake up at all. And I remember waking up, and if you're a mom, you know the feeling of you just being totally full and needing to feed a baby or pump. And I'd kind of thought, wait, I don't think I woke up. And I could tell. So I lean over. He's in the bassinet next to us. And I just, like, he started crying as soon as I touched him. And I knew immediately that it was a cry of, like, pain. It was totally different than a normal, like, I'm hungry cry. And my husband just said, you know, just feed him. I'm sure he's just hungry. He didn't wake up, you know. Which I also know is a red flag as a newborn. No newborn doesn't wake up to eat. So we get him up. I try to feed him. I can't feed him. And I'm getting milk everywhere. So then I pump. John tries to feed him with the bottle. We're kind of, you know, going back and forth with each other. Just we're both exhausted. The twins are now waking up. Charlie's screaming. Everybody's just, it's like chaos in our house. And I just said, I think he needs to go to the doctor. And John was like, I don't know. I think he'll be okay. I think he just needs to eat. I said, no, he's got to go. Like, we got to go. It was just like a intuition. You just know. And so I took him to the doctor, and our doctor saw him. He's great. We came right in. He saw him and immediately said, you need to go to Children's. And I kind of froze, like, wait, this is not in my plan. Why are we going to Children's? He's fine. You know, just can you help him here? Kind of is in my head. Like, why? Why do we need to go? And so I ended up taking him to Children's by myself. I didn't want to stop because I just didn't want it to be like extra time in between the doctor and going there. Our doctor had called the hospital. And so when we got there, they took us right back. We go back. I'm thinking, okay, he's got a cold. The twins have a cold. I'm sure this is what this is. It's no big deal. They see him, and they put the little oxygen meter thing on him and just said, like, I don't know. I can't remember the words they said. Something in like a loud screaming voice, and probably 30 people rushed over to him. They took him out of my hands and just said, we need to intubate. And I'm by myself. I know nobody there. The doctors are all dealing with him as they should be. So I'm just kind of standing there like it's like out of body. Like I was watching somebody else experience this whole thing. So they take him, they intubate him in front of me. I kind of like, I feel like I fell to the floor. I mean, I just remember like thinking, I don't know what to do. And I kind of sat down. And this person came and helped me. It was the chaplain. He stood me back up and just said, I'm gonna help you. Like, let's go sit down. And I was like, no, I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving him. So he helped me kind of stand by where they were helping Charlie. And at this point, still, I'm not thinking, I don't know. I guess I'm still like, okay, he's going to be fine. This is just, we got to get, you know, whatever this is figured out, worked out, he'll be okay. So after they get him situated, they move him to the PICU at Children's Hospital. And there was a nurse in there, and she was like, have you talked to your husband? You know, you need to call him. And she really, like, was a true angel, like, helped me through every single motion that I needed to make next. So we talked to John. He was obviously upset, came to the hospital. His mom came to watch the twins, and we were both there in the PICU. He brings my pump because I still have to pump. Like, I mean, it's just like a chaos still. This nurse is kind of walking through everything. She said, I do think it's just probably, you know, something he caught from the twins. I'm sure it'll be fine. So we start that day a journey of 10 days in the hospital. So he was with us at home for 7 days. And then we started that journey in the hospital. The journey that started as, yeah, he's coming home. He's fine. He has a cold. We're going to, you know, do all the things. So this is where it gets hard, because I'm praying and I'm asking God to heal him. I need you to heal him. I need this to, I need him to be okay. Because I, at one point, didn't want him. And so now this feels extra heavy that he's not okay. And I thought I didn't want him at the beginning of this whole pregnancy. We start figuring out how this is going to work in the hospital. They start doing all the tests. They run a lot of tests. He's in the PICU. He has nurses in and out. Overnight, they're still kind of thinking, you know, this is just a cold. The first night I stayed in the hospital and John went back home. And when I woke up, the nurse was talking to another nurse and just said, she used a word, I think, if I remember correctly, it was posturing. So he was posturing, which meant he was having seizures. And, you know, I'm immediately asking, like, what does that mean? Is that bad? What are you going to do? How do we fix it? You know, is this have to do with the cold? Is this something different? And she kind of says, let me talk to the doctor. You know, we'll get it all figured out. So they put all kinds of stuff on him to just monitor what they thought were the seizures. And they, in fact, were seizures, and they were constant. They didn't stop at all. So they had him hooked up to all this stuff, and then had to also give him a ton of medication to try and get them to stop. When they did that, they also were running tests to see what his brain imaging looked like, just to kind of see, like, what damage had been done from the seizures. So they took him and did that. When they came back with that, a neurosurgeon, neurology department from Children's came in and just said, this doesn't look good. All these parts that are white are supposed to be black. Anything that's white means that it's damaged. I'm really sorry. This is, you know, this doesn't look good. And nobody's really saying, like, what's going on. They're just like, I don't know. You know, there's not. And in hindsight, they didn't have a ton of information, but this neurology team that came in and shared this with us were just very matter of fact, like, this is probably, he's going to have brain damage. And so I was like, oh no, you don't know. My God, he's got it. He's going to heal him. He will be totally fine. This is all going to go away. And I prayed for all of that to go away and for him to just be perfect. And we continue. So this is just one part of our hospital stay. After neurology came and all these people are, you know, doing PT and spinal taps and all. I mean, he has everything that you can imagine connected to him. They start sending his tests, results, and all of these things to other states and other parts of the country to try to determine what was going on. And they didn't learn a lot from a lot of places. There's a lot of just nothing. There's no result. We don't know. And in this time, this nurse was still right there with me. She would, you know, her shifts would be intermittent throughout the week, whatever. But she would come back and check on me. How are you doing? Do you need anything? She was like a constant with our time there. And there was a doctor, too, that I vividly remember helping me multiple times that I just couldn't stand up anymore. I didn't know what else to do. So we're into like day 6-ish. Okay. John is home with the kids all like almost 100% of the time. I'm living at the hospital. I stay there. It's summer. So we're both in education. So we're kind of off, I guess, work. This is probably like the 14th of July. And I'm starting to think like, man, this is not improving. This is getting bad. And the doctor at one point said, you know, she kind of pulled me to the side and I just need you to know that we don't have a lot of information and Charlie is not doing well. And I said, I just need you to tell me that he'll come home. Will he come home? I looked her dead in the eye and I remember like, you have to tell me he's going to come home. And she said, I can't tell you he's going to come home. And that was like, that was where I had to stop and say to God, I can't do this by myself now. Like, I don't know why I thought I could do it before without you. But right now, I can't face my child this sick, knowing that he might not come home without you. And so I was praying before. I was like really praying. I was in constant communication. I didn't stop talking to God while we were there. And I advocated for him, but also throughout this few days, I feel like God was slowly letting me understand that his healing was not going to be here. He was not going to be on earth with us. And all those prayers that I prayed for him to be perfect and for everything to be perfect were going to come true. They just weren't going to be here. And that was excruciating. That was hard. So I want to say like the 15th. 16th of July, they had rounds one day. And the nurse says, everybody was so kind. Everybody was so helpful. But I was so fed up. They were talking about all the things they could add and do and change. And let's do this test and let's do this. And we probably need to take him here and let's add this PICC line and this, you know, just. And I got so upset. And just kind of, for lack of a better word, attacked verbally the nurses. Like, what is this going to help? Is any of this going to work? I just felt like I was at the end of my rope. Like, I cannot watch you poke him anymore. I cannot watch you do anything else to him if it is not going to be good and better and help him and get him to our house. And the doctor that I was close to was actually a husband and wife team, and I was close to the wife, and she asked everybody to leave. Like, I need everybody to go. And she said, I think we need to talk about that. This probably isn't going to get better, and his organs are shutting down, and he's not going to be healed on earth like you want him to be. And so I wasn't okay with that. And I asked all the questions everybody would ask in this situation, like, what else can you do? Are you sure there's nothing else? But in the same breath, I was like, I don't want you to do anything that is going to hurt him anymore, because he's suffering. And I had to watch them every day, like, clean his mouth out with a swab because he had he was intubated and all the things. I mean, just everything had to be checked. And so when she told me that, she just said, I want you to know that you've done everything that you can do, that we sometimes aren't in control. And I thought, how do you know that about me? how did you know to say, sometimes we're not in control? I have no idea if she believed in Jesus. I have no idea. But for her to say, like, sometimes you got to let go. Sometimes this is the path that that we're led down. And so my husband and I talked, and we had to kind of make that final decision of removing all the things that were keeping him alive. And as you can imagine, that was not an easy decision to make. We both didn't want him to be in pain. So there was the peace of knowing that he was going to be made perfect and he was going to go to heaven. And honestly, being here, he would have suffered daily if he had been alive, or if we had tried to keep him alive or anything like that. So I remember too, they told us that we could sit with him, and all of our families came in and saw him before any of this happened. You know, we hadn't been able to hold him a lot, and that was really hard. So when we kind of made that decision to unplug everything and take him off of all the life support and all the machines, I told my husband, I said, I don't think I can hold him when he dies. Like, I don't know if I can do that. And so he said, I'll do that. I'll hold him. I got him. You know, we can hold him together. And they took everything off, and immediately I was like, no, I have to hold him. Like, I couldn't get him fast enough. And I just hugged him and held on to him and felt him literally take his last breath at 10:10 p.m. on July 17th, 2014. It was awful, awful. It changed our whole life from that moment. Everything was different. Everything in our life was different. We didn't know what to do. Like, we didn't know where to go or what to do. We held him for a while, but we also wanted them to be able to do what they needed to do to help other kids that might be in that same situation. So we let him go, and we sat in his room for a little bit, and then we left. We left the hospital, and we didn't have our baby with us. We didn't have Charlie anymore with us. Gosh, it was the hardest thing I've ever done and will ever do in my life. Just watching him take his last breath and leaving him with people that I knew we're going to redeem this brokenness, but also I didn't want them to touch him. I would have done anything to change that. I would have done anything to have him back and going in the car with us back home. But I couldn't. There was nothing I could do. And I think now I've always been in church. I I've always loved Jesus. It's always been part of my life. But that moment was like, I am so angry. And I tried, while in the hospital, I'm like, please, please, please be there. Help me. I don't know how to do this. I just got so mad, not at God, but just at him allowing that to happen. I thought, you could have changed that. Like, why didn't you change that? That's not right. Like, and you knew how I felt at the beginning of all this, and you knew that that would, like, there would be guilt with that, and that would be hard, and you still let that go, let him go. You let that happen. And I mean, I cried those words and yelled those words a lot of times after Charlie died. It was not only difficult, obviously, on me, but it was difficult on my marriage. It was difficult on my husband. It was difficult on our twins. The twins, I mean, they were two, but they knew they had a brother, and, you know, they didn't understand where he was and his room. My mom had to help me take his crib down and take his crib back to the store and hope that they would take it back just so that I could try to keep going. And I asked God so many times, why did you take him? Why are you letting this be something that is going to get in between John and I, our marriage and our, like, what I thought was this perfect family situation? Like, why does this have to be our story? It feels so unfair. Which, life is hard. A lot of people, things happen to people every day, but I didn't think it should have happened to me. I didn't think Charlie should have been taken away from us.
As you are in those initial weeks, and there has to be a certain element of, he's in the hospital, we're going to get him, mm-hmm. right? Just the disbelief that he's mm-hmm. gone. What does that look like, not only physically for you, you're experiencing postpartum, mm-hmm. but then also you have two young kids, and then the physical symptoms of grief are settling in on top of this for you. And, you know, you're headed into a new school year. John is about mm-hmm. to go back to school, and you're from a very tight-knit community, and people know mm-hmm. you're having a baby. For That's sure. great, you know? And so now you're at home with no baby. And mm-hmm. these symptoms and children and life is continuing to move forward.
For sure.
So how do you can't stop that freight train.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, that was rough. And I am a doer. I'm type A. I can always get it done. Like, you tell me to do something, it will be done. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't physically keep my eyes open to do anything. Like, there was no doing. It was just like surviving. I had to just survive. And all the while, I'm still pumping. Like, I'm trying to, like, he's in the hospital. In my head, we're bringing him home. So, especially in the beginning of all this. So, I'm pumping every however many hours, you know, just to make sure I have milk when he comes home. And it was extremely lonely. You mentioned I'm from a tight-knit community. I am from a very tight-knit community, not from there. I live there. And everybody knows Mrs. G. Like, it's Mrs. G. Oh my goodness, Mrs. G's having a baby. Mrs. G's pregnant. Mrs. G, whatever. Like, the kids who've had me, the parents who've had me, like, people do know our family. And you walk into anywhere and everybody is, well, at first, okay, in the hospital, I have like an army of people that are behind me. I think, okay, this cannot go wrong. Like, everybody that I know is praying for Charlie. I mean, our school community went to school, every teacher, and stood in a circle and prayed. Like, they don't all do that. It was just like every single person was behind us and knew and loved Charlie, and they'd never met him. While I'm in the hospital trying to like be normal and read him books and talk to him and also be married and also, like you said, just take care of twins, and the guilt of not being home with them was awful too. Just, I'm here with him, but they're going to know, like, what are they going to think? I don't, and they were two. Like, looking back, I can logically think, like, they probably had no idea I was gone. I mean, now they won't remember that, but it felt so hard in those moments. I was missing their two-year-old life, and I'm barely hanging on in the hospital. I couldn't eat in the PICU either, so that was a weird element too, because I got really conscious of what I was eating and just like couldn't eat. And I think that impacted all of that, those physical symptoms too. I wasn't sleeping, I didn't eat. So I am just sickly and tired and sad and alone because my husband's helping with the kids. And it just felt, I mean, like hell on earth. Like, I would not wish that on anybody. It was hard.
Child loss, specifically for married couples, the statistics are staggering. Mm-hmm. The high amount of people where when they experience child loss that it ends in divorce for them, because there's so many layers and it's so complicated, especially when you factor in how people grieve differently, specifically mm-hmm. men and women, right? Absolutely. You know, each of us process grief differently, but just kind of on a superficial level, men and, right. and women, we process very differently.
Very, yes.
So you and John, you know, you kind of detailed a little bit about just some of the strain that was happening. How did you kind of cross that barrier for how the two of you were grieving differently and just this isolating feeling that you had?
Oh, yeah. That was a huge part of my grief story, too. We grieved as different as you can grieve. I needed to talk and say Charlie's name, and I went to Penn Station and ordered and said, my name's Charlie, just so I could hear somebody say Charlie's name. I mean, I did anything and everything to hear his name and to talk to people about him. My husband was not that way, and that's not wrong. It just wasn't how he grieved. And we were unaware of how the other was grieving. And two, trying to help the other person not lose it, you know, just like trying to hold each other together. But in doing that, we did it in the total opposite ways. Like, I did it in the way I needed to grieve, and he did it in the way he needed to grieve for me. And so we were doing the opposite. It was like he needed like independent, quiet time away to process and do. And I needed like people to talk to me and like relive the story with me and rehash it and say it out loud and talk and whatever. Just even if it's the same thing over and over, I just needed to say it so I could get it out of my head. And it was rough. I would like lay in my closet and cry and just think like, he doesn't understand. And I'm sure he felt that way too. Like, it's hard for me to talk about him because he's not here, but he could probably say the same thing. Like, she's making this so hard on me because she's always bringing it up and I just need some quiet, you know? And so there is this just like expectation of how you think somebody should grieve. And when they don't grieve that way, like, what's wrong with you? Like, why aren't you sad, you know? And so I would cry in my closet because I felt like he didn't understand. And we went through a lot of hard things and a lot of strain. And like you said, the statistics are rough. It's not good. Like, there were times when I thought, this is going to work. Like, are we going to make it? How are we going to make it? This thing in between us is too big. And there was a turning point, I remember, where he went running, and he was training for a marathon, and he would run like far. We lived kind of on one side of town, and he would run to the other side of town. Well, Charlie's buried over where like our school is, kind of. And so he would run across town from our house on the north side of the town to the south side of town, like to the very end of town. And he would go sit at Charlie's grave. I had no idea he was doing that. No clue. And so when he came home and I said, hey, how was your run? He was like, good. I went and saw Charlie. I'm like, what did you just say? You did what? And so it was just like this turning point of, he is grieving. He's just not grieving the same way that I'm grieving. And so I can't speak for him, but for me, I was like, okay, I've got to like not be so hard on him. Like, and ask him all these things all the time, because that's not how he's able to deal with it and handle it. And especially in that first, you know, what, year or two or however, you know, the beginning is just so shocking. Like, you're in shock and you're just trying to like get through the next day. And so for him, that wasn't helpful. For me, that's what I needed to do. And so for us, all that to say, I think finding somebody that I could do that with, and somebody he could, or time he could be away, was helpful for both of us. And we were able to then talk, like I could say, I have to do this in order to get through this. And he would say, I can't do that, or I need to do this in order to do that. And the only way that we've gotten through that is saying out loud what it is we need, and being able to be completely transparent and completely honest to say, I have to share this. Or, and now it's, I mean, we're 9 years out. So we celebrate his birthday. We release balloons. We, you know, do all kinds of different things to honor him. And John's there, and he's supportive, and he is always, you know, willing to talk about Charlie now. It just wasn't how he grieved at first. So
what did the turning point look like for you from, you know, this really turbulent time of early grief, mm-hmm. and just this classical mourning period where time just moves differently, mm-hmm. right? We're just trying to check one thing off the list. We're yes. just trying to get yes. dressed, you know, and yes. and then slowly you ease back into life, mm-hmm. and you aren't crying all the time,
right.
and you are able to go back to work, and you're not thinking of Charlie at every moment. So what did that look like when you started to round that corner where you're still in pain, mm-hmm. but now you're back yeah. into the day-to-day swing?
Yeah. Well, so we had Charlie's funeral on July 22nd, and, you know, everybody's so kind and empathetic, trying to be empathetic, like take as much time as you need. And I just was really struggling with that because I needed to do something. Like I was in shock, and I was mad, and I was like in my own personal body, I had all these feelings, but I didn't necessarily portray that outwardly. So I was like, I need to go back to work. So somebody, you know, covered or subbed for me for, I think, like a week and a half at the beginning of school, just to kind of get everybody back and situated. And then I started doing half days. And then I was like, you know what? I need to be here. And I did not have a lot of grace for myself. Like, I was not willing to, like, I have to be back to Casey. Like, this is, I gotta be back in control. I gotta be like, clearly that didn't go well. So this is what we need, you know, going forward. And there were times when I couldn't hang. I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't do it. And I would go in, you know, my friend's office and just cry, and somebody would, you know, help whatever with my class. Or I would be, you know, a time when they were on a break, I was on a break, and I would just melt down in my car. Like, I just couldn't make it work. And the turning point was really when I had so much anxiety and so much just depression and loneliness. Like I felt like I was the only one, and I was searching for anything. Like, what can I do that where I can meet people where they understand? Well, I went to therapy. I did all the things. Okay. Spent all the money on all the people to help me get through this. And I saw somebody who just said, you know, she never had experienced this type of loss. So it was just like, you don't understand, you know? And so anyways, long story short, I am at church one day and I don't remember how, but a grief support group was brought up. And so I said, I'm going to go there. I'm going to try that. And I was like, John, do you want to go? Nope. Okay, that's fine. I'll go by myself. So it was not his thing. He had his people. He knew, you know, he was just different. So I went, reluctantly walked into that door. I walked back to my car a couple of times, finally got in, started the group. And I was like the person, I'm like, I can't share these people. I don't know any of these people. This is weird. Why did I do this? John was right. I shouldn't be here. Like, all these thoughts are in my head. And they, you know, started the group. And the very first thing we did was, all right, share your story. And I mean, it was just like word just water fell out of my mouth. Like, I had told all the things that were just right there in my brain about Charlie, about who he was, about what happened, how I felt, why I felt guilty, why I was, you know, experiencing all these things. And I can honestly say that night I was like, I think I feel a little better. Like, I was still in awful pain and still had all the thing, all sleeplessness and all, you know, all the feelings and all the things that grief brings. But I thought, oh my gosh, I feel a little lighter. Like, somebody listened to my story. Somebody didn't rush me through it. Somebody didn't say, well, gosh, it's been, you know, a month. You should probably be okay. You have two other kids, or at least you have other kids. Just all the things that people say, not meaning to hurt you, but wanting to help you get through it quicker so they can feel better and you can feel better. And nobody did that. And it was the first time that I thought, okay, God, I feel like you've given me people. I feel like you've given me an opportunity to be with people who understand, and I feel a little less lonely. And that was really the turning point for me. And I mean, it continued to just snowball after that. I went through that session. It was 8 weeks. I brought, you know, just all kind, like, pictures of Charlie, and we just formed this bond with the group that was really cool, really unique, that I didn't have with my friends and people that, you know, even my family that went through it with me and loved Charlie as much as I did. But it just, I don't know, it was just a different, I could open up and share things with these strangers that experienced a similar thing to me without worrying about their feelings, without trying to comfort them, without trying to hold back so that they didn't think I was too upset or too depressed or too anxious or whatever it was. I could be truly vulnerable and honest and tell them things that I don't want to tell anybody else. And so, anyways, after that session of 8 weeks, we, you know, were friends. I thought, you know what? Like, I think I want to go back. This is a weird group that I want to hang out with, but like, it was helping me. It was like a place where I could just get it out. And so I came back and I kind of started like just helping, like in little ways, like, okay, I'll go get the waters, or I'll set out the candy, or, you know, just whatever, just nothing like major. But it turned into helping lead this grief support group for 8 years, like for a long time, and meeting a lot of people that were experiencing the same thing that I experienced. And this is a thing that I think I think it's cool that God has used grief to do this for me. I used to not even probably notice, and I don't even, that's like sounds terrible. There's like a before Charlie Casey and an after Charlie Casey, but I used to not even necessarily notice how much pain people were in when they lost someone. I now see people who have lost someone. I like run towards them. I don't run away, or I don't avoid, and I don't ignore. I like go to them. And even if I don't have anything great to say, and you normally don't, I just sit there and let them be sad, because that's all I wanted, was somebody to just let me say all the things that were in my mind, all the things that were in my heart, the good, the bad, all the yucky, gross things that I thought that I was like mad about or felt guilty about or had thought throughout the whole process. I could say them. And so it's cool that God said, I'm going to take the thing you didn't have, or you felt like you didn't have. And it's not a slight to any of my friends or any of my people, because they were there and they tried and they wanted to be that for me. But they also hadn't experienced loss. So they didn't know how to, just like I didn't prior to this. They didn't know how to sit with me. But I wanted that so desperately. And I found that in this grief group. But the reason I did lead this group for so long was because I wanted to be that person that somebody could run to. Like, I wanted them to be able to call me. And I would always say this to people, like, you can call me at 1 a.m. Because I remember waking up at 1 a.m. and thinking, oh my God, like, I don't know who to call. They're going to think I'm crazy, and they're going to, you know, take me to the doctor, and they're going to whatever. Like, I don't want anybody to fix me. I just want to say this, and I just want to, like, present this sadness so that I'm not the only one carrying it. And so I just think it's so neat that God, in the worst, most awful moment of my life, said, this is terrible for you, but you know how this feels, and now you get to make sure that this doesn't happen to other people you meet and other people who experience this like you have. I just feel like he, again, and I say this all the time, like, I would do anything to have Charlie back. It doesn't make up for missing Charlie, but it like redeems parts of his story and part of my grief, knowing that I can help somebody else, or I can sit with somebody when they're feeling those things.
And we talk about this all the time, just in the course of working with people in their various stages of grief. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so often we approach them with the idea that we're going to comfort them. And yes. Yet, even now, after so many years,
yes,
those moments we continue to learn about ourselves 100%. And our own grief, and even just like the plans that God has for us, and the redemption piece, yeah, and the hope piece. I mean, I think that's what's always so startling when you look to serve this group and this kind of this ministry, mm-hmm, of people that are grieving, that in service, you end up continuing your healing process as well.
Absolutely. And I think too, every year I think, I'm not doing this. It's too hard. I can't do it another year. It's exhausting. I'm tired. I'm like emotionally just drained after we do it. And the first night, every single time we talk, and it's like, we have to be here. Like, we have to be with these people, because it takes us back to that first moment of just like feeling alone and feeling scared and feeling just terrible, all the terrible, horrible grief things that you feel. So, yeah.
And it's almost like you become a magnet, right? Either we're more aware, so we yes, see it other places, or people are just, they know that you've experienced loss, but suddenly, yes, you're hearing about losses left and right, and you're just drawn, whether it's they're drawn to you, or they've heard about your story, or that you work in that ministry, and there are opportunities to be there for people. And I really feel like that's kind of like a God illuminating what the need is based on our own previous experience with
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, for sure. And I've met some awesome people in grief, and I was, quote, their leader, but I don't feel like you said, they taught me so much and walked through it with me and even provided opportunities to do things that have been on my heart for my whole life. I've always wanted to go overseas and travel and support and serve people in other countries, and especially in schools, which is so funny because this past season or session, I met somebody who was fundraising to build a school in her son's memory. She lost her son. She is an incredible person, but she kind of shared that she's doing this school. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, how can I be part of this? Like, I need to, you know, this is awesome. And we do some things for Charlie too, but this was like, it was related to education and kids and like my passion and like drive in life, you know, just like helping kids understand and learn and read. And so I took that information that she was kind of sharing to our school and my students, and I just said, how do you think we can help? And we came up with a project, we raised some money, and I met with her to give her the money that we had raised. And she's telling me all about the trip, and I'm going with my sister and this person, and you know, I think it's gonna be awesome, and we've almost fully funded everything, and some of this money will go to supplies and books. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is awesome, can I go? And I was like, what just came out of my mouth? Like, why did I say that? And I'm like, God, was that you? Like, am I supposed to ask her that? And I just, like, I mean, it was not me. I don't know where it came from, but I straight up asked. I invited myself to Africa with this lady that I met in grief group. Like, what in the world? God is so cool that he can do that, that he just, like, builds these relationships and helps us, you know, like, redeem this crappy, painful thing. And so, and for her, like, it was building this school where she felt like her son was most alive and he, like, thrived and was it was so cool, her part of, like, wanting to build that school and why she was there and why it was at that specific place with those specific people. And then for me to come in and say, hey, I want to go, like, whatever, and for it to be a good timing for my family. Like, my kids are 11. They are, you know, somewhat, you know, independent, can do all the things and hang out in the summer with their grandparents and husband and my husband and whoever. And so it was like, it was just perfect timing all around. And then to be a school, it was so awesome. So I went on that trip with her, and Charlie's 9th birthday was on that trip. And that was, or no, Charlie's 9th angel day was on that trip. So the day he passed, we call it his angel day. And I had gone to the beach because we were, like, kind of on the beach on the Indian Ocean. Yes, Indian Ocean. And I wrote his name in the sand and just, like, said a prayer, like, God, thank you for bringing me here, like, for letting this passion, like, all these passions just kind of, like, mix and be together and be such a cool experience. And it's like, thank you for just letting me meet her. And because of Charlie, I wouldn't have known her if I hadn't lost Charlie. And again, I wish Charlie were here, but he's not. And so to be able to meet her and be a part of this story was so cool. So I did this in the sand. I wrote his name, said a prayer, walked a little bit, and then we're going to do something later that day. And she comes out with 9 blue balloons from the store in Africa. And I mean, the waterworks, like, I just started bawling. Like, I can't believe that you would honor my son on this trip that's supposed to be honoring your son. But it's like, our relationships in this group are. Like, we just know each other on such a deeper level that we can support each other in this way. There was no, like, it was incredible. So then we released these balloons with the kids. The kids, I don't know if they've even ever seen a balloon. Like, it was so cool. They wanted to know what they were and touch them. And so we released them and just said a prayer, like, thank you, God, for bringing us here and for making this vision and, you know, project happen. And those kids have a brand new, awesome school, like, with books, tons of books and tons of supplies, and all the money that we raised from our school went, I picked out all the things that we spent that money on. Like I actually picked them out and put them in the cart and bought them and took them into the school. Like it was so life-giving. It was so cool to just be a part of that story.
So Casey, you know, some people are listening to this story and they're like, that's great for you.
I know. Yeah.
I'm not in that place.
I don't want to do right? that.
and so, you know, there's just so much value to the work that you did, right? Because healing is work, being willing mm-hmm. to face the pain and wrestle with it and wrestle with God, right? Mm-hmm. And wrestle with the close relationships and yeah. really fight for them. Like you fought right. for your marriage, you fought to improve your relationship with God for and, sure. and really just process that pain in a healthy, productive way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for that person who they came home from the hospital without the baby and they feel alone, like so much of grief is just incredibly isolating. And then you add in sometimes these spouse tensions or mm-hmm. partner tensions, and yeah. it almost just threefold of yes. what it might be otherwise. So for that person where they can't imagine the hope piece, mm-hmm. they're in the hard piece mm-hmm. right now. Tell me a little bit about how you would encourage them yeah. in this moment.
I think the most valuable thing I did was even when I didn't think God was listening or he wasn't giving me the answer I wanted, I still prayed or I still sat with him. Like I was mad and there were times when I was yelling and I was upset and I was, you know, very vocal towards God. But then there were times that I was like, I don't have anything to say to you. I don't even know what to say. Or I would like pray and I'm like, why am I praying? You didn't answer my prayer. Like, you know, it was just like, so even when I felt those things, I still was obedient in like talking to him and seeking him out just so that I could, not so that I could do anything, so that eventually he showed up and eventually I could see. It wasn't that he eventually showed up. He was always there. It was just that eventually I was changed and I could see him. And so I think just showing up, even when you feel like this is so stupid, like I don't even think God's here. Like he's not even listening, you know, or whatever it is. If you keep showing up and you keep talking to him, he will eventually help you hear him and help you realize that he wasn't ever gone. He wasn't ever not there. He's always been there. It was just our pain and our grief. And some of that stuff is just so heavy that it blinds us to all these other like good things. I couldn't, there was no way the first year that I went through grief, or the second or third or fourth probably, I would have thought, I'm going to be excited about going on a trip to Africa to build a school in another, all of these things that have happened. Like, I would never have thought, like, this is going to be awesome. Like, I'm going to feel like this is redeeming his story. You know, I would have been like, no, forget it. I don't care about any of that. Like, I don't want any of that good. I want Charlie back. Like, I want him to be here. But I just think there's power in letting God slowly help you walk through all that stuff and knowing that he's putting people in your life, I hope. And like I had to seek it out. So I'm not saying that you should just sit at your house and like hope somebody comes and gets you out. Like you might stay in your bed forever. Nobody might come in there. Like I could have probably done that and my husband would like get up and he would have like said, forget it. Like you are, I can't. Hopefully he would not. But there's not always going to be somebody who is like pulling you out. You have to kind of go after like those relationships. And I think finding, for me, it was that grief support group, because all those people had experienced something that I had experienced in different ways, but I had to like find them and trust them and be vulnerable with them and not just sit and wait for somebody to help me. It can't be like I'm bitter and I'm ticked and I'm not getting out of bed. Like there are times when I didn't get out of bed. There are times when I called in sick for work. There are times when all of that is part of your grief journey, like part of what you have to do to survive. I totally think that that's real. But I also think that when you have that little glimmer of like, okay, I can breathe today. I can take a deep breath. I can put like normal clothes on and I'm going to go like out and find whatever it is. Like I'm going to get a coffee. Like you got to do that if you ever feel like you can, because I think those will build up in time and get you to a place where you can feel a little more normal. Feel like you're just not back, but like you can do what you used to do a little bit.
So Casey, here we are 9 years later. And so after walking through your grief journey to today, it's a voyage that mm-hmm. you've been on, right? It's been 9 years and a lifetime, right? Is what it is.
Right.
Question we always ask is, what does good grief look like to you now after not only enduring that, but working with other people in grief? And then also, like, you've had adventures mm-hmm. because of your grief. I mean, you went to Africa. You just, right. Yeah, just went. Yeah. So now, yeah. kind of through all of that, what does good grief look like to you?
Good grief is clinging to the hope that we have in Jesus, no matter what you feel like, and not running away from your grief or other people's grief, but sitting in it and feeling it and owning it and saying, you know what, I didn't pick this, but it's where I am, it's what I got, and somehow I'm going to make good from this. Like Jesus always promises he will for us. I have to believe that and know that he will in order for that to happen. If I just sit in my bed, if I just waste away, if I'm bitter, there's going to be no good from my grief. There's not going to be, you know, a trip to Africa is extreme. That is a big thing. But like, we have a bench in the park by our house that my sorority sisters and my husband's fraternity brothers from college all chipped in and bought for us. And we go and sit on that bench all the time, and people do, and they take pictures of it and send it to us. And it's like, I can take that. Those moments are just as precious to me as some of my time in Africa, like sitting on that bench and knowing people care about us and love us and are helping us through this. Like, God, you gave us those people. I didn't know in college that any of this was going to happen. I didn't know that those people were going to think like, gosh, I want to show her love. Like I want to, you know, and so I don't know. I think good grief is just, as much as we don't want it, owning it and taking it and holding on to it and just learning to live with it, but in with a twist, like with a good, like trust that God's gonna do good.
Amen. Well, thank you so much for sharing not only your story, but honoring Charlie in such a beautiful way.
Surviving Grief is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio. If you'd like to connect or share your own story, reach out to us at podcasts@crossroads.net. That's podcasts with an S at crossroads.net. We'll see you next time.